accession number 28353, reel 7.
Peter, you said that your aircraft went unserviceable because you couldn't get the wheels up.
Yeah, so I went back and landed on the carrier, but so went through this mental process and said that you, Glover, go on. Partly because that's the sort of thing we always did, and I didn't give it sufficient thought, but also I genuinely, from what I knew of what was going on in the amphibious area, did not think that he would actually be put to any use. I thought he would go orbit for an hour or so and come home. As it was, he was shot down on that sortie, not over the amphibious area, but when he got there, the ship in control of air operations said, well, we haven't got any tasking for you, but please go off to West Falkland and do some armed reconnaissance of the Port Howard area. So he, without maps and things of that nature, knew where Port Howard was from his large-scale map, flew across and thought he saw some activity on the ground, and probably did, and so did a second run and got shot down for his sort of part in it. And we had no idea where he'd been shot down, because as far as we were concerned, he was going to operate over Port San Carlos, but he'd actually gone over to Port Howard. So we really didn't know what had happened to him, how he'd been lost and so forth, which therefore reinforced the message that you never send a singleton. So back to our position where we're now down to two aeroplanes, and one of those is quite badly unserviceable. I go to the Commander Air, and say, I'm sorry, but we will not fly a singleton. You know, we had this problem with Glover, we didn't know where he'd been shot down and things of that nature. So what I want is, if we're going to do any tasking, I need a Sea Harrier to be dedicated, if not to carry weapons as part of a pair, at least to come with an aircraft in order to be able to come back and say that he got shot down over this or wherever. The Navy thought very long and hard about that before they would commit one of their Sea Harriers to flying in a pair with one of my aeroplanes, although at the beginning of the conflict, before we arrived, they were prepared to do attack work. Now, they were not prepared to risk aeroplanes at low level over the islands. And eventually, the command cleared a Sea Harrier to accompany me on a singleton sortie, providing the Sea Harrier never went below 15,000 feet to keep it out of small arms range. That was a pretty impractical way, because that could put him above cloud, me below cloud, and things of that nature. So happened that the pilot that they allocated to the Sea Harrier was a Royal Air Force pilot who said, I know where I need to be on this sortie, and we flew, and by then we were up to two, and then built up to six aeroplanes again. But there were those sort of underlying tensions from time to time, which needed to be resolved and needed a fairly firm stance against the command. Although, again, my own relationship with the Commander Air was a very good one. But you just did need to stand firmly on your ground. The other, I suppose, area of difficulty that we had as a flight embark was that the Navy were not, and the carrier was not organised, frankly, to act as a platform for offensive operations. It knew all about air defence and how to task it and how to mount it, how to fly it, but it really had not thought out how to conduct offensive operations. So they were far from clear on the whole air tasking organisation and misinterpreted some requests from land commanders as tasks and vice versa. They had no proper ground intelligence picture to tell us what we might expect when we flew over the islands and things of that nature. So they weren't well set up for mounting attack operations. Their map store was very small. We didn't have access to the right sort of numbers and quantity of maps. There were no planning facilities for us, so that we had to go and demand a cabin was made available to us so that we could just do our planning in it, because otherwise you were planning in their crew room, which was no more than a cinema, with cinema-type seats where you couldn't put maps down and plan them and things of that nature. So the ship wasn't well set up. Now, all of those sort of things have changed and improved beyond all recognition now, but at that time, in 82, that wasn't the case. So quite a number of sort of issues still to be worked at, but also the opportunity to do quite a lot of flying, which I enjoyed. In terms of my people, I think the air crew, by and large, found the experience exciting, rewarding, and a challenge. I think the ground crew were not so impressed with the whole thing. I think that comes back to ground crew, actually. They can do their job anywhere, and they can do it just as well anywhere. There's not that much difference, apart from it rocking about a bit, as doing it at sea as it is on land. So they didn't get the same professional challenge and satisfaction from doing their job. Moreover, because we were reinforcements, there were no bed spaces, so they were on camp beds in the passageways, and as my air crew were largely on camp beds in the wardroom, sleeping and things of that nature. So living conditions were a bit uncomfortable and sparse in comparison to their naval counterparts and colleagues. So maintaining morale and so forth was an issue and needed to be attended to. One of the things that I found extraordinary in the ship was that the captain, in my 8 weeks embarked, never spoke to the ship's company once in that time. I understand from my experience of Naval Staff course and the week I spent at sea before I went to the Naval Staff College that the position of captain is a relatively remote one for good military operational reasons. But that doesn't mean to say that communication should not be carried out. I mean, the ship had a CCTV system. He could have gone to wherever the cameras were, made a broadcast of the ship, told them what was going on and things like that. But in my 8 weeks, he didn't speak to the ship's company once. I spent the odd evening in Invincible. I'd go across and chat to my naval counterparts over there, who I knew quite well. And the captain of Invincible made an evening broadcast on the ship's CCTV system, just 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something of that nature, told them what had gone on during the day, what the position of the campaign was as he saw it, what they were likely to be involved in the next day, and things of that nature. And it just seemed to me that the atmosphere in the ship was so completely different, whereas Middleton, say, he didn't speak to them once. He only spoke twice, I'm told, on the whole of the deployment. Once on the way down, saying that he expected them all to do their duty and that anybody who didn't would be keel-hauled, or words to that effect. And on the way back, when he said, "You have done a great job, now tell the world how well the Navy has done." And those were his only two messages to the ship's company. But it struck me as being an extraordinary vacuum in terms of leadership, and particularly if the sort of the authority of the captain is so strong, he needs to get his personality down, but nobody ever saw him or heard him, and it was an interesting experience from that respect. Where do we go? I mean, I think one doesn't want to talk about the sort of the individual sorties and things of that nature. Suffice it to say, we did lose some aeroplanes. Fortunately, apart from Jeff Glover, who was shot down and captured, those others that were shot down were recovered and brought back to the ship. With the four new aeroplanes, we got some more crews and things of that nature, so that was good. And then the end of the conflict, the end of or middle of June onwards, then efforts, of course, made to try and find a operating facility in the islands themselves. And I went ashore to look at the race course, which I didn't think was going to be a goer. We obviously had the forward operating base at San Carlos still, and that would operate, but wasn't a long-term thing. And really, Stanley, the airfield, when it was recovered to some sort of operating condition, was the only place that we could go. Middleton was very keen that we disembark now, get off his ship as soon as possible, to allow them to go home. So great pressure from him to disembark, and I had to hold out very strongly for some days to make sure that we got proper communications in place, proper provision of fuel and so forth, so that we could genuinely operate before I was prepared to agree to go ashore. And we did so on the 4th of July, equipped with, I might say, a dozen bottles of New Zealand whiskey, which I had talked out of the ship's commander, or the OC admin wing of the ship, who came to me one day and said, he said, the captain's very keen you leave. He said, I'm prepared to make a case of whiskey available at cost price to you if you will go ashore within the next day. So I said, give me sort of four cases and I'll go tomorrow type thing, because I knew that it was all ready. So we went ashore armed with New Zealand whiskey, which was very good at no price whatsoever. And then we operated from San Carlos, from San Carlos and from Stanley for some months, until such time as they could get the Phantom down there onto the airfield at Stanley. Atrocious conditions, and therefore, again, the need for a lot of leadership, not just by myself but by others within the organisation, to keep things gelled together, because conditions were pretty atrocious. A lot of snow on the ground, living in tents with very primitive facilities, very cold, and a lot of people, of course, who really were now quite keen to get home, because they thought their job was done and so forth. And the programme to trickle people over took quite a long time. Most of my pilots got back fairly quickly, and I have to say that I was quite disappointed not to go back with the team that I had taken down there, but the Air Force in its wisdom said, no, you're to stay for another sort of month or two, and we'll replace you in due course. But so I inherited almost a brand new team, whereas I would like in many ways to have gone back with a team that I took down, but it wasn't to be. So I stayed down there until the beginning of November, and my last sortie down there involved jumping out of the aeroplane and getting fished out of the harbour at Stanley. So it was probably a good time to pack one's bags and leave.
Why did you have to jump out?
The engine stopped.
Over the harbour?
Yes, well, just short of the harbour, yes, but I sort of managed to glide it to the harbour and then jump out.
So the aircraft was lost?
Yes, went into the water, yeah.
I mean, luckily it didn't happen further out than I would have.
Yeah, precisely, yeah, yeah.
And it stopped due to just over wear?
No, it had somehow taken some foreign object damage down. A stone or something of that nature had gone down the engine at some stage and had taken off one of the turbine blades, which then broken others up. So eventually the turbine had just disintegrated, and so there was no longer any power to drive the compressor.
Right.
So though it didn't actually grind to a standstill, it was producing insufficient thrust
to keep you up,
to keep airborne. Yes. Yeah.
Can I just ask this? You don't want to go into the question of individual sorties, and you were engaged. Theoretically, you were a ground attack.
Yes.
The Navy was air defence. You lost four aircraft in combat, I think.
Yes, correct.
That note's correct. How did that happen? What exactly happened there?
Well, Glover was shot down.
He's one of the four.
He was the first one to be shot down over Port Howard on the first day, real day, West Falkland. Probably shot down by blowpipe, a short ground where missile
which we had sold to the Argentinians.
Which we had sold to the Argentinians, yeah, exactly so. The next one to get shot down was Chakwood Iverson, who got shot down over Goose Green when we were supporting the Paras in their assault on Goose Green. And he managed to evade capture, for want of a better word. I think people did look for him, but they didn't find him. He sheltered in a sort of farmhouse and was rescued subsequently by the Army Air Corps once the battle for Goose Green was over. But he was sort of on his own for 2 or 3 days, hiding up, losing weight. The third one to get shot down was a chap called Jerry Pook, who got hit by a small arms in a fuel tank. And although the aeroplane was flyable, he just ran out of fuel just prior to getting back to the carrier. So he ejected almost in sight of the carrier and was picked up out of the water fairly quickly. And then the fourth one was, again, me, who lost an engine over the San Carlos Strip. And I just sort of crashed the aircraft onto the ground. It was a write-off, but I walked away from the bad landing. And and so those were the four aeroplanes that we lost. But only Glover was out of combat because he was held as a prisoner of war for 7 weeks and was the only prisoner of war on the British side.
Of the entire
operation, yeah.
Right.
And he was shipped back to the mainland, or flown back to the mainland. He badly broken a shoulder on his ejection, so he sort of spent the time sort of sometimes in hospital and sometimes in a sort of a prisoner of a war place on his own, because it was like being in solitary confinement, because you know, he was the only one, so he had no one to speak to other than Argentinians who came in and spoke to him from time to time.
So your aircraft were not engaged in air combat particularly?
No,
or
no, not at all. We didn't do any of the air combat. No, we never got involved in any air combat, but we did get a lot of stuff fired from us from the ground, and quite a number of aircraft each day would come back with some form of battle damage, which most of which could obviously be repaired by the ground crew, albeit with some bodge tape and things of that nature. Or, for example, on one occasion, a bullet hit the front windscreen of an aeroplane and sort of didn't shatter it, but dented it and made like a spider's web out from it, which weakened it, obviously, but we had no replacements. And so, again, this goes back to what snags will you carry. So I got my ground crew to think about it, and what they did was they screwed a sheet of aluminium down over the front screen to the point where it covered at least the hole, the indentation, the weak spot, although some of the striations were still there, which meant that only the bottom half of the windscreen front could you see out of. Certainly the main bit was about two-thirds the way up, so the metal came down. So we flew it for a day and a bit whilst we waited for a new screen to come down by sort of crouching down and looking underneath this piece of metal. And those were the sort of things that we did to accept aeroplanes and run them on until we could get spares and so forth.
And you were using the new laser-guided systems.
Well, we eventually got the laser-guided weapon, laser-guided bomb, which of course required somebody on the ground to designate. We couldn't designate for ourselves, so we couldn't drop the weapon and use the aircraft to designate where the bomb was to fall. We had to loft it into a trajectory where then an airborne forward air controller with a laser marker would point it at the target. The bomb would then start guiding and hopefully hit the target.
The bomb would guide itself,
yes,
using...
Yes, it's got a laser nose on the front of it which picks up radiated laser energy. So I'm the forward air controller, you've thrown the bomb up, so it's up here about sort of probably 2,000 or 3,000 feet above the ground, and the forward air controller then turns on his laser torch, pointing at the target. The reflected energy from where it hits the target is seen by the bomb, and the bomb then guides itself onto the target, but it's got sufficient height to do that. If you were to turn the torch on too soon, then the bomb will start guiding too soon and be too low and will actually fly in short because it won't have enough energy to get to the target. So the forward air controller has to wait until it's got to its apogee and then turn on his torch. And so there's got to be coordination between
the pilot. And of course
he's
told when it reaches its apogee.
Yeah, so he knows how long it'll take. So what you need to tell him is weapon released in a profile that he knows it'll take now 12 seconds to get to its apogee. Now turn on the torch and then it'll guide.
Gosh, right.
So a little bit Heath Robinson in those days, but effective, providing the coordination was there and radio contact was there between the pilot and the forward air controller. These days, of course, they can be autonomously guided by the aircraft doing its own designation, or now we've actually almost replaced the laser-guided weapon by a GPS-guided weapon, which doesn't need any laser designation at all. It just knows from the coordinates you've dialed in and will guide itself again, providing it's got sufficient height, will guide itself to that target.
And the forward air controller is RAF or Army?
Could be either. In this particular case, I think the forward air controllers all were Army. There was one Air Force forward air controller who sadly was killed in the accident where a Sea King flew into the water one night. They were disembarking the party of special forces on a particular operation, and he was there for it, a chap called Garth Hawkins, and he was one of the people killed in the helicopter accident. And actually the only fatality from the Air Force during the combat phase.
And there were, as memory serves me, two aircraft flew into each other over the sea, and they must have been Sea Harriers.
They were Sea Harriers. Actually, I mean, to an extent, that's supposition. Nobody actually knows quite what happened to them. But the thought is that they may have had a mid-air collision. It's difficult to find another explanation. The only other possible explanation, frankly, is that they both just flew into the water for some reason, perhaps doing a letdown, misjudging the height or something of that nature. So either they had a mid-air or they just flew into the water. And I think people feel that the chances of them flying into the water aren't very great because they have had a radio altimeter which would have told them what height they were over the sea, whereas a mid-air collision perhaps was more possible. But they didn't know, and nobody will ever find out now.
Thank you. That's all the questions I really want to raise about the Falklands.
So clearly a seminal period in my life, and gave me an experience which frankly none of my contemporaries had had, and few of my seniors had had, because we were now in an Air Force where even the Chief of Air Staff were now post-war officers and had not been involved in any form of conflict, really. And so I was immensely fortunate. I mean, clearly there were squadron commanders of air transport squadrons and Nimrod squadrons that had done long-range maritime reconnaissance, things of that nature, but not who had deployed forward with their squadron and sort of really been at the front line of it all.
Did it leave you with a jaundiced view of the Navy?
No, I don't think so, in fairness. I think the difficulties, such as they were really based on a personality. I don't think it was, although there were some tensions in other areas, the main tension, such as it was between, not me, but the Air Force and this particular individual. Undoubtedly there was a feeling in the Navy that they had got to take every advantage of this conflict to preserve their numbers and so forth, and they really didn't want anybody else in on their act if they could possibly avoid it, to try and get a one-upmanship, I suppose. Equally, I think there was a degree of desire at the highest levels in my own service to try and make sure that the Air Force also got something out of it, and therefore a degree of wanting to try and get more and more into the operation, again to give support in the almost certain battle afterwards for resources. So I don't think necessarily the Navy were any blacker, if you like, in that than we were, but they clearly got off to a good start and wanted to preserve it and keep everybody out. We got off to a not such a good start, nor did the Army and so forth, and wanted to get into it in order to...
Because I think the Air Force was pretty much the one service that came through unscathed from John Knott's review.
Yes.
Pretty much, didn't it?
Yes, we had done. Yeah, we had done. But I think, you know, the chief of the day, which was Michael Beetham, could see the Navy making a strong case for more resources, and that would only be found by the Air Force and perhaps the Army giving up more. And if the Army had already been scaled down a bit, then probably the Air Force were going to take the largest part of any subsequent cuts if the Navy were to have ships reprieved and so forth. Returning therefore to the squadron or to the United Kingdom in sort of November of 82, in an unusual position, and clearly quite a lot of profile, as you would imagine. You know, a lot of people wanting to speak to me, wanting me to brief them, debrief them. So I suppose the rest of my tour on one squadron, which went on from that November through until November 83, so another year, I suppose, quite a lot of distraction by people wanting you to go off and talk about this, talk about that, talk about leadership, talk about combat ops, give presentations and things of that nature. And also time of sort of rebuilding the squadron, because although it hadn't in any way disintegrated, clearly for the period of the, you know, from March through until November time, there'd been virtually no postings in or postings out of the squadron, and therefore now I had got to be prepared to release quite a lot of people, so quite a lot of new faces, and therefore a rebuilding of it. One of the things that took me slightly by surprise was the willingness with which people went back to normal operating environment. I rather thought that some of my air crew particularly, having experienced the freedom of combat operations, riskiest of course, which they would be pleased to be rid of, but the freedom where they basically could fly just as they wished, where they wished, how they wished and so forth, they might sort of want to carry on doing, and therefore going back up to 250 feet where they'd been flying if they wanted to at 20 feet, I thought some of them might find difficult. But actually they didn't. Not at all. They were pleased to be off the boat, and they were actually delighted to be back up at 250 feet, going about their peacetime. And I did find that it was surprising. I thought I was going to have to work quite hard at that, but I didn't. And even those that I might have regarded as being reprobates, led by example and said, "No, I'm very happy going back to peacetime rules and things of that nature." And so from that perspective, it was very easy to go back to being a line squadron, but we did have to sort of get over then quite a lot of movements out whilst we got new people in, and so the experience level of the squadron dropped significantly for a while. We went back about our normal business of sort of the February deployment to Tromsø and the summer deployment to Denmark and so forth and so on. And then I left the squadron having been extended slightly past the sort of 2.5 year point, and left the squadron in December of 1983. Bound back to Strike Command for my second stint there, to set up a newly created what they called briefing and presentation team. A team of three people, myself and two squadron leaders, with a small administrative staff of one corporal, providing the commander-in-chief with all the written briefings that he needed to go about his business as commander-in-chief, whether it were going to a NATO conference at SHAPE headquarters in Brussels or in Belgium, or going on an internal visit to Royal Air Force Lossiemouth, for example, or receiving an inward visit by his opposite number from Canada, or anything of that nature. So any outward business that he had to do other than Air Force Board business, or inward visits that he had to receive, we would provide him with a written brief. Quite a lot we would have to go to other members of staff to get, but we would provide him with a written brief to support that conference or visit, inwards or outwards. And we would also, if we had the Canadian Chief of Air Force or whatever to visit us, then we would also almost certainly provide a verbal briefing with slides and pictures and things of that nature to the visitor about the role and function of the command. Would last about 40 minutes or something of that nature, and then the commander-in-chief would take questions. And so a new team set up by the deputy commander-in-chief, and I was the first sort of team leader of that. And actually...